Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this President's Day, Monday, the 17th of February. Clarence Page is our guest this hour, syndicated columnist and member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. Last week, Congress passed a measure to lift the debt ceiling. How did that happen? Democrats are still hoping for a minimum wage increase, immigration reform, and extending federal unemployment benefits. Will any of those happen? Comcast announces a $45 billion deal to acquire Time Warner. Is this likely to harm or help consumers? Should we be worried about monopolies? The president calls for creation of a $1 billion climate change fund. Another troublesome verdict in Florida. Michael Dunn convicted of attempted murder for shooting into a car full of teenagers after an argument over their too loud thug music. His words: jurors couldn't agree on the most serious charge of first-degree murder in the death of one of those teens, Jordan Davis. The UAW fails to unionize employees at the VW plant in Tennessee. And on this President's Day, which presidents should we study to help guide us through the early part of this century? We're happy to have Clarence with us again. He's been with us several times, and it's been a while now. Syndicated columnist, as I said, and member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board, author of the Pages Page blog at the Tribune website. He's a Pulitzer Prize winner for commentary and is author of Showing My Color, Impolite Essays on Race and Identity. We'll be welcoming phone calls for him. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Please write down your favorite presidents and why. We may get to some of those on the air. And we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Clarence Page, hello.
Hi.
Hi.
Happy President's Day, Kathleen.
Yeah, we're the people who are celebrating as it should be rather than going shopping, right?
That's right.
Absolutely. We're being serious about the day. So in honor of the day, top three most influential, important presidents.
Well, it of course begs the question of most important or influential about what. But I'm going to take your question at face value.
All right, thank you, Clarence.
Just overall, I would rank Abe Lincoln, FDR, and LBJ among the right at the top three as far as most effective overall.
Mm-hmm.
That was throughout their presidencies. There are others. I think that both Barack Obama and Bill Clinton were very effective in their own way. I could name, Ronald Reagan also. As far as the top three overall, making a difference in history, changing the course of history, and also widely emulated by other presidents, I'd say Lincoln, FDR, and LBJ.
What about Washington?
Well, Washington, of course, was of course, did significant things. I'd say probably the most significant aspect of George Washington was that he stepped down once his terms were over. And I think that's very significant because in the early days of this country, there was a big question over who is the president, what is his job, and someday she, I have to say nowadays, they probably weren't thinking about that in those days.
No, they weren't.
But nevertheless, he, of course, set the course for everybody else, and to not have him in the top three doesn't mean he wasn't important, because he most certainly was important, both in war and in peace. But the most memorable aspect of Washington to me is that, like Cincinnatus in the ancient Roman Empire, he came from the farm when he was summoned, and he led his armies, and then he went back to the farm and came back out again and went back to the farm. And I think he established that model of the citizen soldier, citizen president leader.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned Obama. Why, Clarence?
Well, because he, too, changed the course of history with his election. Other than that, I wouldn't call him a terribly innovative president because he followed both the models of Clinton and Reagan in getting health care passed. He did not, in my view, sell health care to the public as well as, say, FDR did. Of course, FDR was dealing with a different circumstance during the Depression and all. Obama had a lot that he was up against. But I think the main thing was he, like Washington and others reshaped the way we view the presidency, and showed, and also at a time when the country needed a big lift of both its psychological feelings and its economic condition, we needed a lift in terms of vision. And he came forth with that hope and change
yes.
vision that, of course, set off a lot of fireworks, but any big political idea is going to set off fireworks. And I think on the whole, he really changed the way we view the presidency.
Mm-hmm. That was an extraordinary night when he was elected. It really was one of the most extraordinary political nights that I have witnessed in my lifetime.
Me too, and I was there
right.
with the big a celebration and all the big news. I mean, I was just stunned when I looked up at the CNN screen and saw Wolf Blitzer in front of a headline that said Obama wins, and I said, "Son of a gun, he actually did it."
Son of a gun.
Up to that moment, I was not making any predictions at all. I look at the pluses and minuses of his possibly winning, and I subscribe to the old Ben Franklin school: expect the worst, you won't be disappointed. And from the beginning, I editorialized in favor of Obama running for the presidency because, you know, what have you got to lose? And your approvals are at 80%. It doesn't get any better than that, so you might as well get out there now.
Exactly.
And you can always, when you're a young man, you can always run again, blah, blah, blah. I wasn't really expecting him necessarily to declare, and I certainly wasn't expecting him to win, although I knew it was possible. I had that kind of faith. And the only question was, could he do it? And it was just a very, very exciting and historic campaign
yes.
all the way around.
Yes, it was. Now, I need to ask you, we won't spend an hour on this, but I think that it's an amazing thing how many people are watching this. I must confess to having watched 4 hours this weekend of House of Cards. I held mm-hmm. myself after I watched 2 hours Friday, 2 hours Saturday. Oh, I want to watch 5 and 6, but I'm holding off until next weekend. I know you have watched, and I know that even the president sent a tweet about
yep.
House of Cards starting. What is it about this show? I mean, it's a fairly dark show. And
oh, by
shows...
the way, that's called binge viewing when you
yeah.
watch a whole, and Netflix is kind of pioneering in that.
I know.
And let me say, first of all, I not only watched the whole first season, and I'm, three episodes into the second season.
Are you?
I also watched the British House of Cards series,
oh.
the original. And I think a true political junkie or erudite individual will watch them both and see the comparison. If for no other reason than if you got any notion in your head that corruption, deceit, Machiavellian politics and all that is an American invention, if you will, remember Shakespeare made his career on it. And it's fascinating to watch the contrast with the British show that the underlying deceit is the same. The accents are different. But what is it? I think, well, for the same reason that Shakespeare, his works live on. There's something very basic going on here, very primal, medieval going on that House of Cards really puts the finger on as far as Washington politics goes, and the politics of life. I watch the show Scandal too. I watch every show about politics, as far as you know, whether comedy or drama. My favorite, by the way, is Veep, the HBO comedy
mm-hmm.
Series about a fictitious female vice president played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, because it really, from what my friends who work in the White House tell me, it really captures the absurdities day to day. Whereas House of Cards captures more the corruption and the deceit. Scandal, I'm sad to say, has kind of gone off the rails as far as how it really began as an inside view of Washington fixers and spin doctors. It's now getting more and more like James Bond, you know. You know real CIA agents
right.
aren't like this, but you don't care because it's fun to watch.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of where Scandal has gone. So I hope House of Cards doesn't do that. But I think the main thing is that it is so close to the way Washington really works and the way the public also imagines it really works, that in the end it really works. It's
mm-hmm.
a watchable show that's very well performed.
It is very well performed.
Yeah,
well, heaven forbid that that's the way that Washington works, though, Clarence. It's pretty dark.
the only difference is, we know once in a while, and I'm not going to do any spoilers here, but there are moves that Kevin Spacey or others will make that really weren't necessary, but they're much more fun to watch than the way people in the real world handle them. Like in the real world, if you want to go after a political enemy or silence somebody who's about to expose you, there are ways of either bribery, extortion, various other ways of arm twisting. On these shows, when things get dull, the bad guy just kills somebody.
I know.
There are not that many assassinations, ladies and gentlemen, going on in Washington, D.C. I want you to know.
Thank you, Clarence. Thank you for reassuring us. Let's talk about what I think was a huge story, a couple of them last week. Comcast announcing $45 billion deal to acquire Time Warner. And there are many people who are saying that really Congress should step up here as they have in the past and have some kind of bipartisan consensus in favor of tough antitrust enforcement. It's hard to believe this isn't going to have a huge effect on how much information we consume and how much we will pay for our cable. This is big.
It is very big, and it's also, by the way, very appropriate that you shift to that topic right after talking about Netflix and the House of Cards, because both of these issues illustrate how the whole media landscape is changing, and the whole marketplace for entertainment and news is changing, just as much as the Internet has moved us away from Gutenberg's model, which lasted 400 years in newspapers, right? Mm-hmm. And now we see everything is being thrown up for grabs in a way, whereas the Internet is this open marketplace. Cable TV and cable broadband are not that wide open. They, in other words, cable companies generally get a monopoly in a certain geographic area to operate. But that's only a cable monopoly. You can still go to satellite TV for your for your viewing. And young people, there's a whole new consumer market growing up now of people who don't even have cable TV or satellite. They're just going to broadband. And turning to Netflix, HBO, right. Showtime, various others, and various other websites for their news, information, and entertainment, and bypassing conventional TV networks. And the networks are very, very aware of this as they're expanding in that area. So the question, the old-fashioned questions about having a legal monopoly, say a telephone company is our best example, right? Back when Ma Bell ran everything, and then We rejoiced in many ways when that was broken up into baby bells, but over time the baby bells have reformed into a whole new type of an arrangement because technology has changed. You remember the days when we used to have to rent our telephone? You couldn't own it.
Yes,
I do. Maybe you aren't that old, Kathleen.
No, I'm about as old as you are. I remember those.
Yeah, I'm dating myself, but I also remember that those phones lasted forever. I didn't have to go to radio
yes,
so I could buy a new phone, that kind of thing. So there's upsides and downsides, but that whole marketplace has changed now. My son doesn't. He's not thinking about landlines. His cell phone does everything for him, including provide the time, like my grandfather's pocket watch, which just indicates how things are changing. So this is all part of the Comcast debate, really, because we don't know if it really does form a monopoly. I guess it was Paul Krugman, New York Times, just editorialized about, well, of course we got to break this up. You can't have big companies absorbing each other like this. You got to break them up. But that's an old reflex that I think that the experience of Bell Telephone shows us that the old model doesn't necessarily hold up because these markets are changing so rapidly.
Mm-hmm. Over the weekend, I know you've written about issues of race and yet another instance of how troublesome this Stand Your Ground legislation has been in Florida with Michael Dunn convicted of attempted murder for shooting 10 shots into a car full of teenagers after an argument over their music, Thug music is what he called it. Jurors could not agree on the most serious charge of first-degree murder, although I guess this case will be retried because it was a mistrial. The death of one of those teens, Jordan Davis, was horrendous. And I'm wondering, what are we going to have a debate again about stand your ground, or is this the way we're going to operate? If you feel you're threatened, you pull out your gun and you kill somebody.
Those are both two very good questions. I think, first of all, the stand your ground debate, by all appearances, is stalled in the water. I won't say dead in the water, but stalled right now, because even after the George Zimmerman, Trayvon Martin case, and people were talking about how, you know, stand your ground has got to be reevaluated, and almost no states have changed their laws, because just a major reason is that the NRA is such a strong lobby right now and in such a strong position, as we saw after the Sandy Hook disaster.
Yes.
There was more of a public fervor for new gun control measures than I've seen since JFK's assassination. And yet Congress was not moved. In fact, the NRA has actually moved backwards from their position in the 1990s, back when they favored universal background checks. Excuse me. Wayne LaPierre, head of the NRA back then, testified before Congress that we need universal background checks. Now he says, no, we don't need universal background checks, that it just leads to invasions of privacy and Second Amendment rights, et cetera, et cetera. As far as stand your ground goes, as outraged as we may be by its excesses, there hasn't been a real legislative change so far. Now, the other question about, you know, is this what we have to expect now? I mean, the guy didn't like, Mr. Dunn didn't like rap music, didn't like being played loudly. This is something that has annoyed many of us, including myself.
Sure.
People driving down the street playing their music too loud. Am I supposed to pull out a gun now?
I know.
And fire away? And he was saying that, he was too threatened by a shotgun. Well, nobody's found the shotgun. And the other question is, was he just looking at a vehicle full of young blacks, hearing this music that he hated, and just reacting like they're going to commit violence, or they're posing some kind of a threat? Stand your ground is supposed to guarantee you the right to be able to protect your own home, your property, yourself when you are under threat. The controversial cases that have popped up like this one are where the threat is either very vague or non-existent. Then there's some other cases that are working their way through the courts as well. But this is the kind of thing that what disturbs me and many other people is, what kind of a signal does the court send? So I think in that sense, it was a positive signal that even though the charge of attempted murder, or excuse me, the charge of murder did not hold up, the three counts of attempted murder did hold up, and a couple of other counts as well against this gentleman, that send the signal that this is a very serious matter. And just because the evidence may not be 100% clear about your guilt of murder, that you at least committed very reckless endangerment here, and you should not have reacted so violently to what was essentially a nonviolent situation.
Clarence Page, our guest for All Things Political, will move into a discussion of Congress, amazingly, passing a measure to lift the debt ceiling. Why do they do that? We'll look also at the UAW failing to unionize employees at the VW plant in Tennessee. Did that happen because of Republican lobbying, or is it just a sign that there is just not a lot of positive sentiment for unions anywhere in the country, particularly in the South, and why that's the case? We'll look at the issues that the Republicans are framing as we head into midterms and into the 2016 presidential races, if it isn't early enough to start talking about that, and look at minimum wage increase, immigration reform, extension of federal unemployment benefits. This was interesting, the president calling for a $1 billion climate change fund, although that will probably have problems winding its way through Congress. So a lot of issues still on the table. And bring up what you would like as well. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show, where we ask you to write down your favorite presidents and why. And Twitter is @KDunnShow. Hour two of our program, we will talk about George Washington, Harlow Giles Unger, who's a very readable historian. We've had him on talking about, actually, George Washington some time ago. He's also written biographies of six of America's founding fathers. His latest book is Mr. President, George Washington and the Making of the Nation's Highest Office. So all of that coming up, and we'll start taking your calls with Clarence Page in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Clarence Page is our guest for this President's Day, all things political, and we're welcoming your phone calls, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Jim in Milwaukee is our first caller. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I've got two websites that people can Google if they like. It's been somewhat underreported, the efforts to have minority disenfranchisement, and in Ohio, there's a website, runninarun.org. A lady named Nina Turner, a black state senator, is running for Secretary of State in Ohio. The second thing that I wanted to mention is that you can Google Christie, New Jersey, or NJ, 1994. And the Washington Post has a story about Christie's run for office in 1994 for what would be the equivalent of a county board in Morris County. And it turns out that he accused two fellow Republicans in the primary of being investigated by the county prosecutor in Morris County, but which wasn't actually true. And he was thrown out of office in the 1997 election, and he also had to make a public apology based on a defamation of character lawsuit. So these are two websites that I think people might be interested in.
All right. Thanks for the call. What's happened to the Christie story? It was headline news a couple weeks ago. There hasn't been much lately, Clarence.
Well, if you watch MSNBC, you probably see a lot of stories. I don't know. It's kind of like a Christie's saga seems to be to MSNBC what Benghazi is to Fox News. My only interest really in the Christie story is he going to run for president or not? And I'd say his chances are sinking lower and lower in the water with each passing day and each new revelation. Even if he is actually squeaky clean innocent of any wrongdoing, just having this kind of a cloud around him is damaging for him in Republican primaries where his base is really independents and swing voters. More than the party's base, which for whom he is not conservative enough. And the independent swing voters tend to be the ones who steer away the most from any sign of corruption or trouble, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, this really is to me, that's the most important aspect of the Christie story. Other than that, it reminds me a lot of Chicago politics, where you've got a lot of appearance of wrongdoing and cronyism, whether or not we have hard evidence.
Right. What about minority disenfranchisement? You can either speak specifically to the Ohio Secretary of State or just to that mm-hmm. issue as we approach the midterms.
Yeah, this is something we can expect this to come up again and again. And I personally think it's kind of sad in light of history that the Republican Party has become identified with what Democrats used to be identified with, which is using voter disenfranchisement to tilt the vote in their favor, oftentimes based on race. This is something that is coming at a time when Republicans nationally are trying to reach out to voters of color, and instead other parts of the party are working on trying to make it harder to vote in ways that we know have a racial component to them. That doesn't mean that only minorities are being discriminated against here, but we do know that both voters of color and the poor tend to suffer the most from from these kind of voter ID laws, et cetera. But the irony of it here is, Kathleen, I really wonder how serious of a problem this is in view of, like, the 2012 election. The very fact that there were these vigorous efforts in favor of voter ID and other questionable tactics resulted in a record turnout of black voters at a time in which black voters were said to be rather disenchanted with Barack Obama and the whole process. Quite the opposite happened. For the first time in known history, black voters had a higher turnout rate than white voters.
Mm-hmm.
And so just the very fact that the issue is out there can work to the benefit of Democrats. So no, who knows? In the long run, it may be a wash, but the issue is not going away.
Mm-hmm. But would that repeat itself? You still have that historical frame of reference here. If it were, you know, it's Barack Obama, the first African-American president. I would think that that would be a huge motivation again for coming out to vote for him for a second term,
yeah,
legitimizing his presidency completely. Well, we voted for him again.
Well, it wouldn't have been nearly as powerful if Barack Obama wasn't perceived as being under siege by his base.
Mm.
That's the irony here again in politics, that oftentimes people come out to vote out of anger at the other side that seems to be beating up on their guy or their woman.
Mm-hmm.
But the polls going into the election, you may recall many of us, including me, were talking about how the left, liberal voters, including African-American voters, were disenchanted,
yes,
dispirited, while the right wing was energized, the
mm-hmm.
Tea Party, blah, blah, blah. Well, it turned out they were not as energized. And of course, Mitt Romney did quite a bit to disenergize them. He wasn't the only reason. A number of things were happening here. But what we did find out, though, was that just because you've got the voter ID laws and other efforts to try to challenge people's right to vote, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have the kind of voter suppression that we saw in the Old South.
Mm-hmm. Last week, I can't even believe I'm saying this, Republicans and Democrats passed a measure to lift the debt ceiling. How did that happen, Clarence?
Yeah, and remember the day when that was not a surprising thing?
I know.
You know?
I know.
It used to be so perfunctory that nobody even knew what it was until all of a sudden in the Tea Party era, we're hearing about the debt ceiling, and suddenly the whole economy's on the brink. Well, I think this shows several things, actually. For one thing, John Boehner is standing up, Speaker of the House John Boehner is standing up and indicating that he's not going to let us go to the brink anymore on issues like the debt ceiling and government shutdown. That it hurt Republicans and it hurts the country. It hurt our Standard & Poor's rating. It's just a loser all the way around. And many Republicans agree with him, noting that, Ted Cruz pushed us into a government shutdown. He now denies it. He's trying to back away from it. But it ironically happened in October at a time when, if it hadn't been for the shutdown, everybody would have been focused on the botched Obamacare rollout.
Mm-hmm.
And now it is much more clear that Obamacare is, or anti-Obamacare, is the central theme of the midterm elections for Republicans. And why step on your own message by getting involved in some budget fight or deficit fight?
Mm.
And so there are a number of reasons why John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, for that matter, over in the Senate, which to me is even more impressive because McConnell is getting a big primary challenge from his political
sure
right.
Is.
And the Tea Party is just furious that this measure was passed without getting blocked or filibustered or whatever. Even though you only got about, there were 30 House Republicans who voted for it, too, over on the House side. And so the Tea Party is furious. They're vowing revenge. They're going to target people, the Republicans who voted in favor of this. John Boehner's future as Speaker may be in jeopardy. He decided that he's just not that's just not worth it all the way around to take the country to the brink anymore. And so I'm very interested in seeing what happens, what he's going to do. There are some rumors that Boehner doesn't expect to stay Speaker past the midterm.
Mm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he hasn't indicated he feels that way. But I have noticed, though, since the end of this past year, you know, when he took to task the right-wing lobbying outside groups that had pushed the government into a shutdown. He had this news conference where he criticizes outside groups. He carefully did not criticize his own fellow House Republicans, but he did criticize outside groups for pushing House Republicans too far, and that they are more driven by ideology than by good governance and all. And so I think that's a big reason why the debt ceiling increase was approved and pushing off another fight until after this election year.
Mm-hmm. And is the administration, Clarence, happy with the sign-up numbers for Affordable Care?
They publicly are happy.
I know they are publicly.
Yes, they kind of rolled back their earlier projections a little bit. But I think what they're unhappy with, though, is the public approval ratings. The low approval ratings
for
the ACA, Affordable Care Act, have not improved. And I noticed that President Obama last week, talking to his fellow Democrats at a time when he's been giving them a midterm pep talk and all, he was talking about how people will remember this moment as the ACA as being very important and all. He wasn't talking about what it's doing right now. And, you know, it kind of reminded me of George W. Bush near the end of his second term, was saying, I think history will judge me quite favorably. He wasn't talking about how he's being judged now, because his approval ratings were very low, lower than Obama's are now. But it's a situation in which the public has not felt the benefits of the ACA enough for its approval ratings to go up. And so right now it's a drag on House Democrats, who are, for that matter, Senate Democrats as well, who are hoping to get reelected this next year. The Republicans, for very good reason, have made anti-Obamacare their number one theme. And if it's not just the sign-up numbers, but just overall the public image of it needs to be improved, which Democrats are hoping they'll see by summertime.
Clarence Page is our guest. Our number is 800-486-8655. And this is All Things Political, which you hear Mondays at 1 o'clock on the Ideas Network. So we're covering a lot of territory with Clarence. Let's go to John in Rhinelander. Hi, John.
Hi. I was wondering what your guest would like to say about Franklin Delano Roosevelt, FDR.
All right. He said that he was one of the most effective presidents, at least at the top of the show.
Yes. I had him number two on my list because, you know, not many presidents do we talk about we associate their name with an era, but we do talk about the FDR era that he established a coalition of voters, you know, labor, minorities, Southern Democrats. He had this broad coalition that enabled him to get reelected three times, and he died in his fourth term. And nevertheless, his mark, that coalition of his, shaped American politics all the way to the 1980s, where a former Roosevelt Democrat named Ronald Reagan became president and really made it his mission to reverse the FDR model, the New Deal model. Of government and politics, largely succeeded. Like Roosevelt, Reagan established a new tone of politics that it took Bill Clinton to really effectively use in a way that pushed back from the left. And as I mentioned earlier, we saw Barack Obama win and govern largely with a mixture of both. And he's got his own style, but he, I think that Obama thinks big like Ronald Reagan, big, broad concepts. He's not the great communicator that Reagan is. Few people are, nor is he the the folksy populist communicator of Bill Clinton, you and I talked before about how the Democratic Convention this last time, Bill Clinton gave a better speech in support of Barack Obama than Obama did.
He sure did. He was good. And he was pretty wonky in the process, you know, still able to get the audience. John, how do you rank FDR as an effective president? Is he in your top three? Are you there, John? Ah, John is gone. Feel free to answer that question as you call in this afternoon. After all, it is President's Day. Clarence Page is our guest, syndicated columnist, member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board, author of the Pages Page blog at the Tribune website. And he is with us from time to time, and we're glad he's here today. So we'll take more phone calls momentarily. Here's how you can reach us. You can call at 800-486-8655. You can send an email, talk@wpr.org, or go to Facebook, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go to more phone calls for Clarence Page. And Stella in Sturgeon Bay is our next caller. Clarence, hi, Stella.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a question that's been puzzling me for quite a while, which is whenever a president of the United States runs for a second term, it's always said this will be his last race, the last time he's running for office, and so on. And the question is it legal for a former president to run for another office? Is it simply tradition that they don't? Or is there anything actually legally preventing them from running for some other political office?
Well, it's more tradition than anything else, although it has happened. And here maybe some caller who's a history professor can run to my rescue, because I do believe there are one or two examples of presidents who have served afterwards. I know those vice presidents. John C. Calhoun was a cabinet vice president twice, I believe, as I recall, and then went back to Congress. I don't remember all the details now, but basically it is more a matter of custom that presidents have not run for office afterwards. And frankly, from my point of view, who can blame them?
Right. Thanks, Stella. Jim in Geneva. Hi.
Hello?
Oh, Galena, I'm sorry. Geneva, I was thinking of Lake Geneva.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think that FDR was so successful because we were in such a condition that Congress had to work with them. Meanwhile, 50% of all the filibustering that has gone on in the United States House, in the Senate, has happened in the last 6 years. They will not work with the man, and I think in some way we're in as bad a shape, and I think we should be judging any president that's had a rough pull. Look at the Congress. You'll find out that there was people just working against him. And the Democrats did work with George Bush after that horrible thing on 9/11. And that's all I got to say, and I'll listen to your comments.
All right, Jim. Thanks for what you had to say. Clarence.
Yeah, I'm glad he brought that up. This is why it's so painful for me to just say, you know, the top three presidents were the most effective, because he is right in that when Barack Obama came into office with more challenges facing him than any president in American history. Why do I say that? You know, two overseas wars plus a major recession at home. That alone is more than any previous president has come into office facing. At the same time, nobody promised him a rose garden except for the one behind the White House. I mean, he knew what he was getting elected to. And even he himself, you know, I've told you about how Dave Axelrod, his political advisor, who was an intern of mine in the 70s, which I point out to everybody, he noted how Obama himself privately joked about how he might not have been elected if it hadn't been, if things weren't so bad at the time. But it's the fact is that he was up against more, and he is in many ways up against more resistance to the legislature, certainly than FDR had, certainly than LBJ had, and that facilitated their ability to get things through. But at the same time, neither FDR or LBJ had complete unanimity of support by any means, and both had to lobby, and LBJ especially, working the phones, grabbing people's lapels to get the Civil Rights Act and Voting Rights Act passed, and the War on Poverty measures, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to count all these things, I think, both what handicaps is the president working against, and as well as how effective they were in getting legislation passed.
Clarence, do you see any possible movement on minimum wage increase, immigration reform, extension of federal unemployment benefits, or a $1 billion fund for climate change?
Well, okay, yes, yes, no, and yes.
What did I say? What did you say?
What was the first one?
The first was minimum wage.
Okay, first of all, minimum wage. I am pessimistic about this Congress. Republicans will prevent it from happening, while at the same time, we're seeing state by state the minimum wage going up around the country at the state level and the city level. That is an example of the laboratory of the states at work. In Washington, President Obama, by executive order, is pushing up the minimum wage for federal contractors and what they can pay their workers, which is a start. For the most part, we're seeing more action at the state level, which is true of a number of issues. The second one you mentioned,
immigration reform,
yes. Here again, you know, John Boehner wants immigration reform. We saw him recently, a couple of weeks ago. He said we need to get immigration reform passed this year. And then like a week later, he comes back tail between legs saying it's not going to happen because he had such a backlash, mainly from Republican members of Congress from districts that have very few Hispanic and other immigrant group that are pushing for this legislation. And there's been just a big pushback from the political right in the Republican Party that makes it look grim for this year for the measure to get through.
Unemployment, federal unemployment benefits.
Oh yes, unemployment benefits they just lost another vote here in the Senate, I believe it was about 3 weeks ago. I just wrote about this because I like to see us revamp the way we do unemployment here. Something more like what the Germans have.
You wrote about that, yeah.
Yeah, putting aside some of the unemployment. Well, instead of mass layoffs in Germany, companies can choose to have across the board pay cuts, and then the German government gives those workers partial unemployment to partially make up for the pay cut, which means they're working 4 days a week instead of five, for example, and they get compensated for maybe half of that fifth day from the government. Meanwhile, if they want to pick up a part-time job and work that day, they can, maybe even come out ahead. This is something that's called work sharing, and 27 states now have some form of work sharing. Illinois, it came up, I know, in the General Assembly last year, and then it just died in committee because more people need to hear about this.
Yes.
It's a good way to revamp unemployment because right now we've got a robust financial economy, money economy, but unemployment is still too high.
Mm-hmm.
And this is has caused the big debates about unemployment compensation. And in the olden days where would have just naturally understood that unemployed people deserve to get help from the government, that's now a matter of debate in the new Tea Party Congress. And that's what's holding up a flat increase in unemployment insurance for now.
We'll do a show on that, on work sharing. That sounds good. We'll get back to...
I'd be happy to help you with that.
Thank you. Thanks, Clarence. All right, we'll take you up on that. We'll get back to climate change, but let's get some phone calls in first. Rosalind in Woodruff. Hi.
Hi. I I find it hard to pick just three also, but Thomas Jefferson, to me, was a very important president and in many ways got lost in his Lewis and Clark expedition. One of the factors was that of coal captains. And to me, that speaks so incredibly why that expedition was successful with only two or three people dying in this expedition, going through numerous different nations of peoples. And we would have a lot to learn. We could learn a lot from studying more the Lewis and Clark expedition in all its dimensions, both political, geographically, environmentally, public relations with other peoples and other cultures. We've lost the richness of what Thomas Jefferson invites us to look
at. So you'd put him way up there in terms of effective presidents, Rosalind?
Pardon?
Would you put him way up there among your top three?
You bet.
All right. Thomas Jefferson, Clarence.
Well, I'm a big admirer of Jefferson, which gets me in trouble with so many of my African American friends who remind me
he owned
slaves. So right. did George Washington and all. And there's of course the whole scandal around Sally Hemings and all with Jefferson. But you know, when you look on the whole at Jefferson, the full richness of the man, he was quite a fascinating figure and one who, like Abe Lincoln, was the kind of politician who was trying to balance these conflicting values, where he was the author of the Declaration of Independence and believed in the Enlightenment principles of human equality. At the same time, he owned slaves, and to me, it's symbolic and emblematic of the fundamental ideological conflicts in which this country was born and that we're still trying to resolve. But I've been to Monticello. I invite everybody to go to Monticello, learn about Jefferson's life, because he, in so many ways, was a fascinating individual and at the same time, a flawed man.
Mm. One smart fellow, wasn't he? I mean, he
Absolutely.
Was so accomplished in so many areas.
And he had a very open mind. People think he invented more than he actually invented, because he was great at going over to France and other places and finding ideas and bringing them back.
Mm-hmm.
And so that in itself, and of course, building up a tremendous library that became the Library of Congress today.
Yeah. Thanks, Rosalind, for the call. The Global Fund, the president called for $1 billion for a climate change fund. The Secretary of State, John Kerry, over the weekend compared those who deny the existence of climate change to people who say that the Earth is flat. And yet we hear that maybe Congress isn't going to do very much about this. The weather has been wild the past few months all over the world. Are we going to do something? Is a $1 billion fund anywhere near what is needed, Clarence?
That's a good question, and it's hard to predict politically which way this will go, just as that Keystone Pipeline issue. Same story there, you know. Which way is that going to go politically? I think President Obama is preparing us to for an approval of the project, but we will see. But in any case, I think what's really interesting to me here is that this is like the flat Earth versus round Earth people, that it's become an article of faith among people of a certain ideology that climate change is a hoax.
Right.
And don't bother me with the facts. And we've seen a lot of this in the last few weeks of people saying, well, look at this weather. What happened to global warming?
Mm-hmm.
Ha, ha, ha. You know, there's a difference between weather and climate. And overall, the climate, like President Obama said, overall the climate indicators are that there is a warming. Now, we can argue about whether or not human beings have much to do with that warming. Obama and Kerry have said yes, and I think there's a lot of evidence in that way. But the debate itself, there's such a strong force from the other side that opposes climate change legislation, that it's hard to say how much money President Obama will be able to get approved, if any.
So you don't have much faith in that area either. You know, it's interesting to me today, and I'm finding this, you hate to make a broad statement out of a small sampling, but it's interesting that all the callers wanted to talk about earlier presidents and earlier times on the show today, because there isn't a whole heck of a lot that's taking place in Washington. It's like this constant pitting one side against another side, and very little is getting done. Do you have that perception?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true that there's not that much getting done right now. And well, historians will spend a lot of time debating as to why that's true. But number one, though, the past is safer to talk about. It's always easier to praise a dead president than a live one or ex-president. And, you know, I don't mind jumping right in there and saying I think Bill Clinton, like Jefferson, was a very effective, if flawed, president. You know, if you look at the Lewinsky scandal and all that. But I don't think the Lewinsky scandal is an issue now if Hillary Clinton runs for office, even though there are some who want to try to make it such. But the I think right now, though, after the Obama, the whole debate about the Affordable Care Act led to its passage, President Obama has not appeared to be that excited about a lot of other changes. Now, he his
about 10 seconds.
His stimulus efforts began to fail, and he's run up against a brick wall so many times that he appears to be weary of that fight as well. So we will see.
Clarence, thank you. It's always such a pleasure to speak with you.
You too. Thanks. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Clarence Page, syndicated columnist, member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour and Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Tomorrow at this time, an assault on a California power station raising alarm on the potential for terrorism.